Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for having me. As Ulysses mentioned, my name is Michelle Horvath, and I serve as a judicial administrator. My hope was that I could talk about a quick overview of the process, what our office actually does, and then have about 7 or 8 minutes for questions or feedback that you want to give to our office. So the role of the judicial administrator is to receive, investigate, and pursue violations of the campus code of conduct. Now, what's really unique about our campus code of conduct is that it actually is a campus code. So it covers faculty, staff, and student, in addition to student organizations. With faculty and staff, that behavior has to occur outside of the workplace. So if I had a student in my office and I just start yelling at them, and I'm just, I could say that there was some pedagogical reason for me to do that, and that's directly within my workplace, and maybe HR would be the venue in which a complaint would go. If I decide that I just want to go ahead and slash people's tires because they're taking the parking spot that I like to park in, then I would actually get jailed and be sent to my office. And so it's a little bit of a distinction in that regards. But issues of, for example, domestic violence when it comes to faculty and staff because they're not under policy 6.4 would come to our office in regards to harassment and things of that nature. So just remember for the faculty and staff side, it is having to occur outside the workplace. Another unique factor about our code of conduct is that it has a very high standard of proof. So most college campuses have preponderance of evidence. So is it more likely than not that something happened? In the criminal justice system, we have a beyond a reasonable doubt. In the middle is this thing called clear and convincing evidence. So it's somewhere between 70-75%. So it has to be substantially likely for the behavior to occur, which is a little bit hard sometimes for my office to meet some of our burdens of proof because we just have to meet that really high standard. The code defaults to being an only on-campus jurisdiction. That could be extended if there's a serious or threatening violation to an individual or campus safety. So, for example, if somebody was underage drinking on campus, we would take jurisdiction easily. If somebody was drinking off campus underage, we're not going to ask for off-campus jurisdiction because it doesn't require a higher serious enough level. When we look at a case and reports come through our office, mostly through our online reporting form, and this is a form that's accessible to anyone. Community members, they have to just kind of call our office because we require authentication so that people don't file false reports against each other, or we have a venue to make sure that we can see where an anonymous complaint comes from. What we do is we do an analysis. We say, do we have subject matter? So our office does not cover academic dishonesty or sexual violence for students. So if somebody says, a professor fills out something and says, hey, I would like to file a complaint because somebody broke into my office and stole a test and then used the test for subsequent use, we would take the break in an entering part and the academic dishonesty would stay with the college. Code conduct charges have to be charged within 365 days. There's a few exceptions under the code. So, for example, fraud, there could be a little bit of a longer time, and we can ask the chair for an extension. So if we have jurisdiction, our process is we send someone a notice letter, basically saying, we think that there's some allegations of the code of conduct on this date. Here's what we are charging with. We want you to come in because we're only hearing one side of the story right now. You have a lot of rights under our code of conduct, which is really wonderful. And so one of the most important rights is the right to have an advisor and support person of an individual's choice or an organization's choice. And that includes our judicial codes counselors. And these are four law students who are in their second and third year of law school who really serve as, I hate to use the word opposite side of the prosecution because our office is the prosecution office, but they're really serving core in that advisor defense capacity. When we meet with a respondent, and that's a term we use, we don't say defendant, we don't say accused, or the respondent, because this is an educational administrative process. We basically say, what happened? This is the information that we have found from our investigation. Sometimes individuals come in and they're like, yep, not even gonna deny it, that was me doing this on Friday night. Sometimes it's not to the point that an individual and organization has reached that understanding that their behavior is volatile to our campus code of conduct. And what's interesting about our office is that we interpret the phrase freedom with responsibility to mean adult choices and adult consequences. And so our office is never going to tell somebody don't do something. That's not our perspective. We just say that if you feel so passionately about something that you're willing to make these choices, You just have to accept responsibility for the consequences that come. And the reason we say it is that you as an individual, you as an organization, you as a faculty or staff member, have come to this campus with a specific set of values. And those values are enshrined in our campus code of conduct. And so a campus code of conduct for Brigham Young University, which is a historically religious institution, their code of conduct looks very different than our code of conduct. And the reason that it looks different is because we say that each institution is certifying the characteristics of its graduates, employees, staff in a very different way. So when an individual says that, I graduated from Cornell, I work at Cornell, our organization is part of the Cornell community, what we're stipulating is that, yes, they are, and they can comply with these values. So we adjudicate matters. Most of the time we're able to reach what's called the summary decision agreement, which is kind of, I hate to use the word plea bargain because we don't plea, but it's an agreement that both sides would say, yes, there is clear and convincing evidence that the following violations have been met. And I agree to these sanctions. Our office takes a very restorative justice and educational approach to sanctions. And that's not to say that there aren't times when the behavior is so egregious that separation or dismissal is the most appropriate educational intervention. But 95% of our cases tend to be written reprimands, written papers, reflection papers, drug and alcohol counseling. If we're unable to reach a decision and an agreement, we go to a university hearing board, and that's comprised of faculty, staff, and students, in which both sides presents what they think is relevant for the facts and an application of the code. If there's a finding of responsible or any sanctions that have been applied, the appeal would go to the University Appeal Board, which is comprised of faculty and staff and students, just smaller. And then in certain instances, in acts of violence, the appeal can go to the president. And so I know that's kind of a quick overview of that. I want to definitely leave some time for questions, but I want to go back to kind of the educational approach that we have. And so we understand that people make mistakes every day. If we think about our mornings already, you know I sped to work today. You know, I know I was running a little bit late, and so I went a couple of miles over. And so if I got stopped, I would have to take responsibility for my actions. It's not that I'm a bad person for doing this, and it's not a detriment to who I am or what I'm going to achieve in the next phase, but if I were stopped, I'd have to take responsibility. And that's sort of the philosophy that we have with the individuals who come to our office. Is, you know, maybe it wasn't much about the decision making. Maybe it was factors outside of your control that led you to do this. I think we spend a lot of time trying to understand those factors because nobody wakes up and says, you know, I really want to go see the J tomorrow. I have nothing better to do. It's always resulting for something. So an individual who was caught and found responsible for underage drinking because they haven't found a friend group has a very different reason for that alcohol consumption than somebody saying, I have a serious alcohol problem and I don't know how to control it. And so when we look at the sanctions that would be appropriate and educational in those, we really look at the circumstances and the decisions which led to that. So that's a quick kind of overview, and I'm happy to speak with anyone at a separate meeting to go into depth, but I really want to ask for your questions or your thoughts or comments, and I'm really kind of turn this into an open space for the last couple minutes we have together.
Questions for Michelle or comments?
I see Christine.
Could you provide a little more clarity around the definition of the workplace with regard to faculty? So if they're in a building in the hallway, is that their workplace? If they're in the classroom, it seems pretty clear it's their workplace. If they're in their office, but what is the nuance?
Yeah, so it tends to be really fact specific. So if on the onset, if somebody's walking down the hall, right? I don't know, is that part of their workplace? Were they walking towards another meeting or were they meeting a student? Again, I don't want to give a vague answer, but I'd have to wait on the facts. And so if we had a case where someone said, well, this happened on Seneca Lake. And so on the onset, it might say, okay, this is clearly outside the workplace, but let's say they were chaperoning a trip there. Mm-hmm. Then it's back into the workspace. And so that's something that we would consult with HR, with the Dean of Faculty, to really kind of make that determination and really kind of review that.
Chris?
Same question about online behaviors. Like if students, faculty, staff, anyone away from campus, and there's an online interaction that's clearly harassment or somehow against the code, is that in your jurisdiction?
So that typically falls outside the off-campus jurisdiction, right? It's really hard for us to say that some of the behavior occurs on campus. And, you know, as we see social media and the advent of really the idea of using these spaces in a way that they weren't intended, I think case law, court law, and colleges are still trying to figure that out. But we're really coming from a point that there would have to be a demonstrable way in which that would meet our off-campus jurisdiction standards. The exception to that is our no contact directives, which are issued by our office. They do apply to electronic communication, and we issue those so infrequently that it's almost a non-issue for our office.
Other thoughts, questions?
Moni?
Are there distinctions made in terms of what is considered on campus, because we are a very decentralized university, in terms of are certain university-owned buildings, even though they're not directly on this area here, is there still that jurisdiction because it's owned by the university?
Yeah, I don't know if you can give me an example.
So East Hill Plaza or buildings that are in the College Town area. I assume that certain facilities are owned by the university. And so when we talk about campus, do we just visualize it just in this immediate area in terms of Cornell campus where that jurisdiction is over?
No, it doesn't have to be contiguous to Central Campus. So East Hill Plaza is covered. Roosevelt Island falls under my jurisdiction. If a student group has a bus that they're taking to an athletic event, that bus is considered on campus because it's being used for an educational purpose at the time. So it doesn't have to be central to the Ithaca based. When it comes to campus ownership, that's one factor that we would consider, but it's not always the determinative factor, right? So
I guess when you talk about on campus and off campus, like as well as it's. Okay.
Yeah, that's a good distinction.
I don't want to talk until everyone.
No, please go ahead.
When you talk about like preponderance of evidence and reasonable doubt, and I think you mentioned like percents, like 50 to 75. Are those metaphors, or is it actual? You know, 50 and 75, or is it just is it actually when it must be a definition of these things out there that people use percents and. And you say we have a high standard. Is this a point of contention that we're at this higher standard than a lower? Just maybe comments on all that stuff.
Yeah, so the courts don't really have a percentage definition with the exception of more likely than not. And they say it's 50% in a feather. And so kind of the example that I use is a good kind of hypothetical. So if I had walked into this building and I have an umbrella that's dripping wet, it's probably more likely than not that it's raining, right? We could kind of say, yeah, more likely than not. If I had beyond a reasonable doubt standard, we would say, let's all go outside. We'll exit the building, make sure that it's raining, make sure somebody doesn't have a sprinkler off the top of the building, and then we can say it's beyond a reasonable doubt. So clear and convincing is somewhere between that. So we might say, well, Michelle has an umbrella, looks rainy, there's windows there, let's pull back the blinds and see if there's precipitation fall. And so usually it's about 70 to 75%. I think one of the challenges with that is because we have such a high standard of proof, our levels of accountability are actually much lower. So we as a campus are saying that you have to be here for this behavior to be problematic instead of being here. Most college and university communities do use preponderance. And if you think about it, in the court setting, clear and convincing is usually used when people, for example, have their children revoked from them, when their parental rights are terminated. I think the reason that we have such a high standard is because we have faculty and staff in our code, and the university rights and relationships are very different and have historically said that a tenured professor or an endowed staff member has a higher property interest that the university needs to protect than merely having the opportunity to be a student at a certain school. So I think it's contentious in the part that there's behavior that we can't hold individuals accountable for unless they voluntarily want to do some of the education we would describe.
Matt?
Thank you, and Thank you, Michelle. Not necessarily, I actually was here for another reason, but in terms of just to Charlie's point, I'm the chair of the University Assembly's Codes and Judicial Committee, so we are the committee on the University Assembly that originates most code amendments. So just to provide context, and actually also I work closely with the Judicial Codes Counselors, and the point of view that they generally put forward is that not necessarily that you need to be here to rehear, which is what's wrong, but it's what needs to be proven. So in terms of, you can also look at a quantum of evidence, preponderance versus clear and convincing, as based on what level of error are we willing to accept as a community. And Cornell traditionally, and is the, I can say this with confidence, it's the official position of the Judicial Codes Counselor that having that higher bar shows that Cornell is more serious, that we're less willing to tolerate false positives, we're less willing to sanction someone, I mean, we're not necessarily sure they did. We don't go to beyond reasonable doubt. We maintain that higher standard for that point. And traditionally, the Judicial Codes Counselors have held that, and so has the Codes Judicial and the University Assembly have also generally tended to support maintaining that high standard of proof.
Fantastic. So, if there are no more comments going on right now. Thank you so much for coming, Michelle. I think this is probably part of a larger discussion. And Charlie, you'll be joining us to speak about the consensual relations process policy revision that you're going through at our next meeting. But during our retreat, just so both of you know, we did talk pretty extensively about the relationship between faculty and staff in particular, and kind of the, I don't want to say the condescension, but the mistreatment that many folks on the assembly expressed that they had received about how faculty are treating staff. So in thinking about the code in that much broader context, and of course with HR policies, it's something that we probably should think about a bit more and how we can actually mend those relationships. But thank you again for coming. I'm sorry to cut you short. We have quite a bit on the agenda today. So if there are other questions for Michelle, please do send them my way or send them to her directly, and we can send one big email to you so you can have a whole in discussion.
Perfect. Thanks,
all right. Y'all. Thanks again.
Thank you.
We're going to move in now. Tanya?
Yep.
There we go. So Tanya is joining us. And is Kim there too, or did I make that up?
Right here.
Okay, right
next
to you.
Me. Got it.
I was wondering when I was trying to take roll, I wasn't sure. I was like, surely nobody changed their hair color. Fantastic. So Tanya and Kim are here to do kind of a presentation / focus group. And Tanya, I'll let you describe exactly what you're doing. So go for it.
All right. And I'm going to actually share my screen, if that's okay.
Try.
Let's see if it works.
Wow.
She's doing it. All right. So Kim Swartout and I have been charged with looking at the current model of performance management here at the university. And we did a survey. So I'm going to share some survey results and ask you guys to share your thoughts and opinions. Wearing your staff hat, we represent broadly across the university. And this is a great opportunity for us to really capture what might be of interest to groups, what we want to shy away from. So I'll go through this, and Kim is going to take some notes, and we'll ask some questions, and we'll try to go through this as quickly as possible. So when we were charged with looking at how we do performance management at the university, we thought the best thing for us to do was start with a survey. And since doing a full campus survey takes lots of time and approval, we did a representative random survey of employees. We surveyed 899 people, roughly 15% of our staff population, excluding unions and excluding academics because they are not bound by the same performance management process. We received good representation, 309 employees, 151 managers. This is fairly consistent with the composition of manager to staff ratio at the university in general, as well as composition of different generations represented is similar to our makeup here at the university. What we found is that 97% of employees value the performance dialogue, their annual performance reviews, that they have them, which is really great. We wanted to see that. We'd love to see 100%, but we'll take 97. What we found is that employees, and the way we broke this out is employees who simply receive a performance dialogue from their manager, and managers who hold performance dialogues with their employees and managers who receive them as well. So they're responding on two ends. What we found is that for employees, 60% found that performance dialogue to be very important to them, whereas 41% of managers found that valuable. So a little bit of a difference there. And what we found in the attached comments was that employees felt like they were putting a lot of time and energy into developing the performance dialogue, into taking care into responding to those questions, and they weren't seeing the same amount of effort put in by their managers. So that is why I think we see a little slightly lower number there. As far as importance, we broke that out again by generation. So as you can see, for both millennial employees and managers, they're pretty equal in the importance and the value of it. As far as boomers and Gen X, you see a significant drop or difference between people who don't supervise and people who do. So there's a lot more value placed for the employee than the manager. That we also referenced against the employee survey and found in this an even amount or similar amount of employees who found it useful, though they didn't break out by manager and non-manager. Things that were most valuable in the discussion: goals, progress, you're making areas of development, strengths, etc. We then asked a question. So we are thinking about how we can change the performance dialogue process. What we found is that many employees get lots of great feedback from their supervisors. They're having one-on-one meetings or bi-weekly meetings. They're having that FaceTime. They're having those conversations. And they want more of it. Employees are saying, I want more opportunity. I want to hear more information. So we asked the question of managers of, would there be interest in having a quarterly conversation, sort of a check-in versus the annual or something else? So 35% of folks said, you know, they were interested in quarterly, 40% annual. This other 25% actually moved somewhere into the less than annual, but some more than quarterly. So they fall more in that quarterly bucket. So just curious from this group, what do you think about performance dialogues? Valuable, not valuable?
Yes. Can you please clarify again, excuse me, the definition of the manager feedback?
The definition of manager is, if I was Kim's manager and Kim had no direct reports, so if I had direct reports and I'm giving them a performance dialogue, so I'm meeting with them to talk about their performance, I'm a manager.
And you're talking about the experience you're having in giving her dialogue.
Yes.
So we asked, do you supervise or do you give your team member a performance dialogue? And so that those are captured in the manager responses.
Yes.
But they also answered as an employee because they would get a performance dialogue.
Yep. So they're answering, is it valuable to me getting one and is it valuable to me giving one?
Okay. And so when we look at it, it looks like the millennials are 60% would like quarterly. So as we move and our, you know, workforce gets a little bit younger, we see that, you know, the trend is moving towards more frequent communication.
So I think the value really depends on what kind of feedback you get day to day. Like my supervisor gives me good, timely feedback all the time. You know, things I could do better, things that went well. So the quarterly report or semi-annual or annual wouldn't affect me. But if I could see if someone feels like they never get any sort of feedback, that it might be more valuable to have it more frequently.
On a similar note, my supervisor is exceptionally good at regular feedback. However, I still find value in the performance dialogues, mostly around the goal setting for future career planning. Because it's a dedicated set aside time that we talk about where I want to be in the organization and start defining and laying out that plan with the assistance of my supervisor, who's actually very good at it. So
I would echo that. And I feel that it's the only time I get that conversation. I get a lot of feedback, but I don't get the how to get me to the next place and where they want me to grow and learn, except in that dialogue.
Right.
And I feel that that's also what happens and is the value of my conversation with my staff. It's just that dedicated moment of
where do you want to be and how do I get there?
Yeah.
So more so the, not the day-to-day stuff, but the future, the stuff that we don't ever get to because we're busy doing our day-to-day. Is that
right.
What I'm kind of hearing? Okay.
But I would also add that if that annual dialogue or semi-annual and the bigger picture and the goals never goes anywhere, or if there's yeah. never any resources or opportunities associated with it, then it's useless. Mm-hmm. And that's it, sometimes been my experience. There's no follow through mm-hmm. for many different reasons.
I echo that. I'm sorry, but with my current supervisor, the performance dialogue has been completely worthless. He lives in Boston. He doesn't really know what goes on one-to-one. Our department manager has year after year, it's, you know, months after the deadline when he should have filled things out, he just rubber stamps some previous incarnation. And, you know, recently I saw a copy of this and he had put in, you know, a job description from my predecessor in the position. It's a completely different position that, you know, has no bearing on what I'm doing in my position, really. And there's no dialogue part of it either. We never meet to discuss it. This is just a signature on a form. It really is an irrelevant process, and it's a shame. And I try to make it with the people I'm supervising a much more of a discussion. But, you know, as you were saying, we talk all the time. When I see something that's done well, I try to praise them. When I see something that, you know, they should be working on, it's an ongoing thing, so that there should not be any surprises in that annual, you know, review.
And when we say we might move to quarterly or triannual, it wouldn't be as labor intensive as the annual review. So that's kind of what we're trying to get. You know, everybody goes back to January or whatever to say, oh my gosh, what did I do 6 months ago? And it's hard to say, oh, that goal didn't happen because who knows, somebody, you know, that your partner could have been out or whatever. So it's hard to remember everything that happens. So how could we like address your situation and try and fix like what's going on there?
No ideas. I mean, having an absentee boss is you know, he's also faculty, so you know, nobody can make him do anything.
That's what was I was going to lead into. So when you were looking at managers, were you looking at distinguishing between a regular employee, like just a staff, or someone who was an academic employee? So faculty supervision has normally been quite an issue when it came down to regularly staff getting their feedback. In a timely manner, having it, you know, productive. So how is that going to be possibly addressed or distinguished between all the data you're bringing us?
So that is not something that we're able to look at because it's very difficult for us to be able to, in randomly surveying, it's difficult to pull in faculty and know that they're a manager or not. So we didn't address that. I think we will have to go back and address that differently. And I know it's being talked about. We are also looking at, not Kim and I, but others, at supervisor feedback and that relationship between the employee who is supervised by a faculty member mm-hmm. and the fact that that is often more challenging in a different way.
And I think that goes back to what Ulysses was referring to earlier.
Right. Charlie, since you're here, any thoughts on that one?
There's a lot to digest here. Can I interject a question
yes.
here? I looked it up just now. Like, what's the definition of boomer, Gen X, and family? I'm sorry, that's another percent question. I'm a math guy, so I hone in on this stuff. But it seems that, you know, I looked up just now, and it's kind of vague.
Shouldn't you just publish
age groups? I mean,
so we could go back and populate it as age groups. We do have we have them broken out by age group, and we can do that, and I can send that.
Okay. Oh, it just seems like when you do a survey, it should be kind of a little bit more precise than that. I just, you know, I sort of old, middle age, young is how I'm looking at that.
Right. I have a little bit. I mean, it is very different because there are, you know, some people who are really on the cusp of, you know, like I'm only a few years difference between a Gen X and a boomer. You know, there's, if you go to 12 different websites, they'll give you 12 different
right,
age ranges.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Carrie has something to add.
Hi. I guess I just want to say, like a few other people, I do have a really good relationship with my boss and I get good feedback. We're very close. So the performance review is never a surprise for me. And I like to have it, but for me, I would say in my mind, I connect it with advancement one way or the other, it used to be more tied to salary improvement than it is, I think. Or advancement sort of career-wise. But for me, it's sort of a downer. And I don't know if I'm just an outlier, but I've been told for several years now that because I work remotely, there's nowhere for me to go, and there's no, in terms of advancement. And so I've sort of reconciled with that personally. You know, I've like had some nice conversations with myself, and it's worth it to still to continue working remotely. But I just think I would love to see that sort of investigated a little bit, just to see, like, is that really a policy? Is that true? Or is it just my current, you know, my group that feels that way, that that you can't take on any sort of leadership role if you're not on site to be a supervisor? So, you know, for me, it's, you know, the performance review, it's all well and good, but I never, nothing ever comes out of it for me. So, just thought I would mention being a remote worker.
Thanks for sharing that, Carrie. And we've got some remote workers who are connecting in on some of our other focus groups. So you're the first one who's brought up that advancement opportunity. So thank you for sharing that.
No problem.
Yeah, just to
talk about how to facilitate a quarterly.
Yes.
So Human Ecology does all performance in Workday.
Yes.
And I know that there are other colleges who have emphatically stated they will never do their performance style out of Workday. I feel like the tool in Workday has made the process so easy. And I really feel like, if there was more, I know where we are in the context of Cornell, we mandate nothing, but if there was much more encouragement and understanding around how easy it is, quarterly feedback would be nothing. And then there's metrics. You know how many employees
Absolutely.
Have had them and how many have not. It's all there, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know how to, our college just, we're just a size that makes it really easy for us to do things like that. So mm-hmm. I don't know how to roll it out. I don't have any ideas like that, but I do know that the tool can really facilitate and I think could solve a high degree of dissatisfaction around the process.
And it does, when they put in the talent management module, it will have the option to do the quarterly. So it won't require so much as the annual review, but you could just write down, yes, we went over our goals.
Yeah.
This is still pending. We'll look at this next quarter and then hit submit and it's there for the next time that you look at it. So we're hoping and we're looking into Workday to see if at the annual time all three of those quarterly, you know, check-ins that you had would populate the annual one. So fingers crossed that would be helpful.
We're using the goals module right now.
Okay.
And it's, again, very easy.
Good.
And it shows up in the performance. I mean,
Great.
It's there when you go in the next. So,
Right. So,
Workday's the answer.
Yeah, and our hope is that whatever we do, we'll have those pieces that will flow into into that performance style. And so at the end of the year, the one that you have to attest to has everything in
right.
it ready for you.
Yeah.
So there's not extra work. Perf, I think you had something.
I had a couple of comments. One is I was very fortunate over my whole 36 years at Cornell to have very small groups, and I was a manager and managed in both cases, but I got lots of positive feedback. I did find that even in my small group, I had occasionally employees who were really good, but they were terrified of the performance review, and it can be very frightening and stressful for the employees. So I'm not sure how to, maybe quarterly would help that. The other thing is, from a manager standpoint, which didn't happen to me, but other people in larger organizations, as the organization shifted, their criteria changed, and so they were limited in praising an employee to a certain extent. So that, you know, where they would say give fives, they were no longer able to do that. It could only be fours, and I'm not sure what that had to do with the organization, but it also made the managee, the workers, much more skeptical and frightened of the process because, you know, they were essentially been forced to be downgraded in their mind. So there's a lot of stress involved for employees in management, you know, performance reviews especially at the end of the year, where they're kind of all, you know, well, we got to get this done. And I think doing it quarterly might reduce some of the stress and also give the managers more opportunity to manage, or, you know, to be forced to engage a little more often with the workers if they want.
Thank you.
I also think we're not trained to accept feedback. The training is about giving it.
Mm-hmm.
And we found in the college, we did a mandatory 360 for everyone. And you might already know this, but the experience we had is that it was a very different experience to receive feedback, and we hadn't prepared people to understand how to take it and have it be a positive element. So it feels like if going to quarterly, while it will create more frequency of the dialogue, training about receiving feedback, I think, could be really helpful.
What other training, thoughts on training that we could do to prepare people for having conversations?
Oh, I've heard, I mean, I don't know if you've looked at this across different categories of employees, but I've heard consistent accounts from certain levels of employees that they don't feel like they have any voice in
mm-hmm.
these encounters. And I think equipping all sides
mm-hmm.
to feel empowered and actually even accept the notion that they have the right to provide feedback always and have a voice, and this is an opportunity for them. I don't think everybody's comfortable doing that or have the skills to assert their own needs, and maybe more initiatives around that.
Can I ask, are you thinking about staff at lower levels
lower
giving
levels.
Feedback up?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's actually something that came up in the survey, that employees are feeling 44% of them who responded felt like they can't necessarily give, either they either don't or they only do it on occasion. And when we asked why they don't give it, many of them came through because they're fearful, lack of anonymity, all of the things that we know and have talked about. And there is a group focusing on that supervisor feedback vehicle and how we can change that so that there isn't that stuff in there. Monty?
I guess I would echo the supervisor feedback. So when I receive my performance dialogue, it goes through Workday. So kind of everything is tracked from what the supervisor says to my responses. But in terms of providing supervisor feedback, it's an email that's coming down.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not going through that Workday process in a sense to kind of get tracked. And so sometimes not sure if we have feedback in regards to our supervisor, if that's actually being communicated or included in their performance reviews.
So that feedback, so that email that you get in, might be a Qualtrics survey as well? Is it, do you get a Qualtrics survey?
It has varied through the years from just a regular just email. We're asking, you know, for some feedback. There may be a couple of questions, you know, so it hasn't really been, you know, consistent.
Part of the reason why it doesn't go through Workday is as it goes through Workday, your name is tied to it. And there was a lot of anxiety for people feeling like, I feel very comfortable in giving my supervisor feedback. Others are not so comfortable in putting their name to feedback. So by using that other mechanism, it allows your supervisor to get that feedback and pass it down. So it should be part of their performance dialogue, though you don't see it because you're not privy to there. But if they're using the mechanism appropriately, that feedback should be trickling back down to your supervisor in their dialogue. Just a thought, because Herf mentioned ratings a few minutes ago. How do folks feel about performance ratings? The 1 to 5 that we have now. You know, the meet succeeds. Frequently exceeds.
I can make a comment.
Carrie? Or is it Carrie? Or is that not Carrie?
It's Kathy.
Kathy, thank you.
Sorry, I'm getting a lot of feedback. Are you guys able to hear me?
Hang up your phone and just use your computer, I think.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Perfect.
Yeah.
I can hear nothing.
Oh, we can hear you.
Okay.
Turn the other way around.
Turn on your speakers. She can't hear me. Should I turn on our speakers?
Turn on your speakers,
get a
Kathy.
Message. Little message.
But we can
so
all do
yeah. Yeah. We're working on that policy survey response
right, yeah.
thing. We've received a lot of discussion around one of the representatives on the team works in CIT, and they eliminated all numbers last
mm-hmm.
go around, and she said it was phenomenal. It like transformed the experience for the entire work team.
And there are some organizations that don't, so you don't even get the meeting or exceeding, or you don't get any final score, I guess.
And is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I would say in the organization that I'm aware of, the numbers weren't turning into anything. So it's, I would say, more honest.
Charlie? So just to make an analogy to grading students and courses, is it, do you see like grade inflation and having trouble this, you know, everybody gets to getting A's and B's and what the signals are? And also, I mean, people, you know, some instructors are hard graders, some are not, right? It doesn't mean you're a bad supervisor or teacher, say.
Right.
So how does that stuff figure in there?
So I think that that's part of the comments that we heard, that some supervisors say a 4 means this, and some supervisors say, well, in my estimation, that's only a 3. So what is meeting and what is exceeding? And we have guidelines to that, though there's no policing of it, the same as a hard grader or an easy grader. What we have found is a lot of comments from employees who were saying that the grade that I get doesn't really matter, because if someone gets a grade lower or higher, what it's correlated to in terms of potential SIP is the same.
Everybody gets a 2, whether I'm a 5 or I'm a 3.
Right.
So is what we're
hearing. So there was a lot of comments about why am I getting this, or some, as Herb said, supervisors who are saying, well, if I give you a 5, what do you have to strive for? Or nobody's perfect, so I can't give you a 5. Right. Or we're only allowed to give so many 4s and so many 5s and so many 3s and whatever. So lots of anecdotal stuff on that. So we were curious if they actually are valuable in any way, shape, or form.
So one of the things that I've heard in academic reviews, these reviews in the past, is we never give 5s. And we never give 1s unless we're firing you. So it's really, you only ever get a 2, 3, or 4, and it's generally a 4 if you're doing really well, and 3 for everything else, and hardly ever a 2 unless you've had something go. But nobody gives 1s, nobody gives 5s.
Let's go to Kathy real quick. Go ahead. Oh, did you unmute your phone?
Her phone's on mute. If somebody can unmute.
I got it. We'll see if this works. Go ahead, Kathy.
How about now? Can you hear me with a lot of feedback?
There you go.
Okay.
It's working.
So just briefly, I want to follow up on the number system. And unfortunately, I missed a couple minutes of the conversation while I dialed back in. But in my division, now, fortunately, I have a great relationship with my supervisor, so I kind of feel like this hasn't been a problem for me, but I hear this every year, and it relates directly to the number that's assigned. They do try to tie it here to the SIP, and so we're always told, well, the employee isn't told this directly. I hear this simply because of the supervisors that I know that have been told this, and it comes all the way down from the vice president level. You're not given a 5. You gave out too many 4s next year or this year. So next year there should be really hardly any 4s at all. It's so that's kind of demotivating. I heard a lot of complaints from the staff members here in this division about that. And nobody wants to consider themselves average. So they look at a 3 as that's really fulfilling all their responsibilities, which are significant at this point as we cut positions and don't fill them. A 3 really is good, but everybody wants a 4 or a 5. So the number system, in my opinion, has become a demotivating thing for the employees. Does that make any sense to anybody else?
Absolutely. And that's the gist of, I think, what you missed.
Good. So I agree.
And I think
next.
That's kind of what I was referring to too. Is you only get a 1 if you're getting fired, and you only get a 5 if you're getting promoted. And other than that, there isn't anything.
Yeah, this is Carrie again. Oh, sorry.
Like, it doesn't mean anything, and people use it to mean things that it doesn't mean.
Right.
It's just this play currency that gets passed around between a work team and different work teams. And unless we give it value, we need to stop pretending like it means something.
And the other issue I've heard is, again, Kathy mentioned, it's divorced from the constraints that you're facing also in your unit and your job. So, you know, not getting a 5 because some mistakes were made, but you're doing two people's jobs.
Yeah.
Right. There are contextual factors that aren't always actually considered in terms of the environmental constraints.
Yeah.
And I will say that one other thing that I've seen happen personally is you'll get an exceeds expectations for going beyond the expectations of your job position. But in the next year, that's become the expectation now.
Yeah, that's just the norm.
So now you're a 3 because you're doing the same job you did last time that was a 5. And actually now, if you don't complete that, you're now dropping your level. So the definition of expectations changes based on your performance.
Carrie, I think you had something.
Yeah, I was just going to echo some of what Jeremy was saying, but, you know, to me, in theory, the rating system, whether it's numbers or text labels, whatever you want it to be, in theory, I think it's very valuable to me. I personally like to sort of look across whatever period of time, and I like to have that sort of summary assessment. You know, I may have done differently on different things, but I like to have that sort of summary. But, you know, I think it was 3 years in a row that we were told that the division was recalibrating our numbers. And so that, you know, again, like what other people were saying, it was sort of artificial. You know, it wasn't, or my supervisor was told what she couldn't, what she could and couldn't do. And at our level, I think my direct supervisor has no input on any sort of tie to SIP. But it's just, it feels very, I think it doesn't work because it's not used properly. And when the numbers are artificially manipulated, it just, I agree, it's a demotivating thing. It's sort of like, why even bother? But I think it could be used really well. It just depends.
So Tanya, that goes, I mean, this is great, and looking at how many respondents you got, breaking it down age groups, managers, not managers. But realistically, though, whether we do it once or 4 times a year, I think really one should address the accuracy of this, actually how we use it, the consistency. Why are we doing it? Are we doing it only for dialogue, or are we doing it for SIP, or are, you know, that is realistically way more important than whether if we're going to start switching it to 4 times a year.
Right.
I mean, I'm sorry to say, mine is great. I love it. My boss is good. But a lot of other employees, for them, you know, before we go into changing how many times we do it, we need to address.
Yeah.
Because
yes.
I think what's being said, at least I'm going to paraphrase, kind of gathering some of the thoughts here, is the usefulness really depends.
Yes.
The weight of the usefulness is really put on that manager and
right.
how
yes.
decent they are at their job.
So that ties into, you know, we want to pull this whole thing apart and change it. Along with it, we are looking at, we've got another group who's looking at something called prioritizing leadership and recognizing that managers either don't have the time or the inclination to manage their team. So what does that look like? And we're actually looking at how we define what it is that they are responsible for doing.
Exactly.
So there are all of these pieces that will tie into this. So there will be a lot of movement and change in terms of how we have those conversations, wanting managers to play more of a role of a coach and an advocate,
mm-hmm.
and really recognizing the work of their employees. So
that will then have to be across the board. If
yeah.
a manager is a faculty member, a manager is an employee,
yeah.
we should have them and hold them to the same accountability.
Yeah.
Because otherwise employees are not getting the benefit
right.
of what you are supposedly recommending.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. This issue with faculty supervisor is so loud in the survey.
Mm-hmm.
It's every almost every conversation we have in policy administration,
yep,
faculty supervisors come up.
And I'm on the promotional reward subcommittee, and it, again, every meeting has focused on,
yep,
supervisory relationships, but especially the issues with faculty, yep, and staff.
So what I want to do in the interest of time is to talk about the one other piece that we have that links with this, which is recognition. And you gave us a nice segue into there a little bit, Tammy. So one of the things that we were also charged with looking at is what kind of recognition opportunities are offered to employees, what they would like to see. So some info, lots of stuff being offered, training opportunities, low cost, no cost, though we have found that not a lot of people are necessarily using those or don't know where to find them, that sort of information. And then just commonly known university programs. So I just thought it was interesting to see that several of these things that we have out there really nobody knows about.
Yeah. And those are our highest percentages. So it was really eye-opening. With managers, and we had a 23 or 22-year employee, and she said the first time she'd seen most of these was when she took our survey. So I was like, so it's really like, we definitely need to increase awareness of these awards. Maybe we've also heard that the nomination form is a little too lengthy. You know, oh, I thought about doing it, I started it, and then I missed the deadline. So we would try and work with that group to maybe make the nomination form a little bit easier. But 40% of managers are looking for more options to ways in which they can reward their employees. So we often hear, oh, I wanted to get so-and-so a movie ticket. I went back to my desk. I had a meeting. I went on throughout my day. 2 weeks passed, and I missed that real-time recognition piece. So what we're doing is we're meeting with some vendors, and so we hope to have some connection with Workday, and so that a manager can go in, click on the recognition tool, go in and say, oh yeah, I want to give this person either points or a Cornell sweatshirt. We're not quite sure what we're doing yet. We have 6 or 7 vendors we're looking at tomorrow morning. And so that would provide that real-time recognition.
Awesome.
What do you think about that?
That's awesome.
No, I think that's fantastic. Yeah.
A new car. I don't know about a new car.
I'm not sure about
The other thing that we hope that it will allow for is some peer recognition. So if I wanted to recognize you for some work that we did in our project together, I could go into Workday and give you, Workday calls them badges, but they're little like icons that you could go in and write like a little note, and it lives in your Workday history. And your manager will see it.
It's almost like endorsing somebody on LinkedIn for a skill.
If we could get that badge to go into LinkedIn, that would be even better.
Charlie, did you have something?
Yeah, I brought the following point up when they were looking for the new vice president for facilities. So I made this point. So, you know, like in April or whatever, there's an event in Barton, office staff, awards, lunch, and whatever, written up in the Chronicle. Then for the 2,000 employees that work for facilities, there's something in the summer, nobody comes to it, and it's a blurb in paw print. And I think that asymmetry is bad. And I brought up in the context that the faculty have to be much more attuned to facilities than they are now. Right now, if, you know, the heat doesn't come out in your office or you're building us a new building, suddenly I'm interested. But there's just a very great underappreciation for those 2,000 employees. And I think that was a real a signal to me just how is the award setting. I think there should be symmetry there. So,
go ahead, Matt.
I actually have to step up. I just wanted to say, as someone who has undergrad in ILR and is now at the Johns School getting an MBA, it's not surprising, but it's interesting that the schools are teaching the individuals going through and getting degrees from Cornell. This is the way that you're saying is exactly what you shouldn't do as a manager. And I've had at least 3 or 4 faculty who I know are doing, who have done and do research on this topic or do consulting. And obviously the faculty engagement, especially at the various ranks of the employee hierarchy, is different. But in terms of information, being able to even pull some of that research and apply it, I mean, it's very easy. It's very hard. A lot of the faculty who I've worked with moan, oh, organizations won't give us access to really their nitty gritty, so we can't really study them. Well, it is really, I don't see a reason why a Cornell faculty wouldn't be able to get access to more of Cornell's data to do a study in terms of, even if it's an internal one of, here's how Cornell could improve. And again, I don't know much more answers, but I figured it's something that might be prudent to at least look into.
Yeah.
Great idea.
Any other just quick thoughts, and then we'll wrap us up on ways that you would like to be recognized that you'd like us to bring back or think about? We've got in our listing thank you cards, you know, real or electronic, low cost, no cost, which are things like movie tickets.
Well, we're also going to be updating our variable pay guidelines. So we're trying to create a university framework. We know colleges are going to tweak it, like Human Ecology has one. IPP has the Keystone Award. So they give out a certain dollar amount for each award. So we're trying to at least create a university framework and update the guidelines. And then the colleges can tweak it a little bit within that framework. So at least there would be something out there that employees and managers can see to say, oh, okay, I did this type of work and it's kind of worth this amount. You know what I mean?
So I have a question. If a manager can give an employee a badge on Workday, could an employee then give a manager a badge?
Yes.
You know, because supervisors,
absolutely,
excellent mentors, and really should,
absolutely,
you know, there should be some kind of way of recognizing it.
Yep.
That's a great way to model, to have regular recognition connected directly to the values you want to inculcate. Towards
managers. I don't want to cut anybody short, but we are running up on time, so I just want to.
I got that. All right. If anybody has anything that they'd like to share after Kim and I are happy to get your thoughts, your feedback, your comments. Our hope is to finish up our focus groups and then share some recommendations in November and hopefully move some things forward. Thank you
to the both of you, and please do share your recommendations with us. I'll come back again. Well, Tanya, you're always here,
sure.
But both of you are welcome to share that out. I hope Charlie, I think he might have left the room, but I hope he knows he has quite a bit to do now, based on this conversation. So
I think PLR just ran out to make sure that he knew that. Caught him on the way to the elevator.
Okay, so we're going to move on to our late additions. Tanya, did you want to very quickly?
I'll ask Gina, because I don't think our parliamentarian is here, so I'm going to put you on the spot. We've got two nominations or recommendations for the employee award. Can I send that as an informal poll and have people vote on that?
I think the chair allows that.
Would that be okay, Ulysses, we have two recommendations. I can send out an email and people can give their yay or nay to one or the other.
Yes, actually our bylaws permit electronic voting for actions like this. So as long as you send out the profiles or whatever it is we're reviewing so everybody has the information and give us a deadline for voting, we can do that.
Perfect. All right, I will do that. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you. Jeremy, I'm sorry. Is there a question?
No, nope. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Jeremy, let's turn it over to you to both the statement and let me separate this out. Before we do your resolution, first on the docket, everybody should have received a copy of the statement that we were thinking about putting out. So this is something that we crafted via email, via our executive committee listserv, and of course Carrie, our resident, everybody took a red pen to it, but of course our resident VC of communications took a red pen to it as well. So we just wanted to make sure that we ran it by everybody. Because this is an EA statement, so the statement is not meant to necessarily, say whether or not somebody is guilty in this investigation or whatever it is. But we're saying these are our values as an institution, and we want to make sure all employees are respected, everybody's respected, but employees can come and make sure they go to work and everybody can be safe. And then a final call to action to make sure that employees broadly get involved with the EA, so we can help propel some actions forward to change. So we can open that up for a brief discussion, but I do want to, the goal of just that is to get a simple vote of approval for the statement. Does that make sense?
Yeah, motion to approve the statement.
There's been a motion to approve. Is there a second?
And if it's possible, if we could close that door, because I hear Pilar and Charlie very well.
We have a second.
There's a vote. There's a vote. Look at that. There's been a call to question. There's been a second. Is there any dissent?
I actually had a request to give another moment to finish reading through that.
Sure.
Can we just give folks another minute? We are speaking in the voice of the assembly, so I want to make sure that everybody's happy with what's worded there. And if there is issue, let's talk about it.
What are we beginning to review?
That's
proposed actions.
There. I have one that's coming up shortly. That's just going to be presented. It's not going to be voted on today.
Yeah.
We expect further resolutions to come in, specifically focused around this thinking. There's nothing specific though, but it is a commitment by the assemblies to really be thinking about during this term ways that we can improve the campus culture making it a safe place for everyone.
Again, I want to be very clear that we're not committing to any, well, that sounds really bad. I mean, we're not committing to anything. No, we're not committing to any specific course of action right now, as Jeremy said. As you got from the president's statement, he's convening a task force on this. And so whatever actions we think of, and I've already had to submit some, had a quick submission of some names to send to them, but whatever we get when they refine the charge for that task force, hopefully we will be able to think about some things in that context. So until that happens, I don't think the assembly itself is not pushing forward anything aside from, you know, just making a commitment to start thinking about ways to improve culture. Does that make sense?
I have a comment about the text in the last paragraph.
Sure.
And that is, you say you can get involved by joining a committee, but it doesn't say if that's an EA committee or not.
It doesn't.
Attending EA meetings, so someone could be like a self-appointed member of the EA, or is that an EA committee they can join, or just any random committee?
Both. So it links into the get involved page on the assembly's website, okay, which has a full list of committees, and so people could join a UA committee that might have a different scope. So we're not limiting to people. It's really just a call to action, because the goal is to put this in multiple channels, so our Facebook, whatever, so people who read it might be interested. You know, if a student sees it, they might be like, you know, I might want to get involved in the committee too. So, you know, they might be driven to the assembly's website is the goal. Final thoughts. So I'm going to give Jeremy, make sure you have some time to.
Can I get a high sign from everybody that they've had a chance to read this? Just.
So I'm going to,
move to
approve this, this statement for publishing. Is there a second?
Second.
We have a second.
Is there any dissent? Seeing no dissent, I'm going to ask for unanimous consent. Is there any dissent to that? Seeing none, the statement is approved, and Carrie, we can go ahead and publish at will when you and Chris too. I know your social media lead, so when you all get a chance, Jeremy, go for it. You have like a
okay. So in the last couple minutes here, EAR 6. This is just an introduction for EAR 6. I actually, in improv, that I may have some of my own amendments as this goes. I'd like you all to take a look at it, really parse through it, because one of the things we're looking at are the very specific issues that have arisen on campus, but in a broad sense, they're indicative, they're symptoms of larger issues. And one of the things I'm looking for is some actions that we can take specifically focused around employees to help improve that culture. And what you'll see in the resolution is a description of a set of whereas clauses building up to the problem. And the subsequent resolve clauses currently are a call to first, explicitly and without any equivocation, condemn these acts of violence and discrimination from the employee assembly. We've already done that in some extent in the statement, but I'd like to continue including that in the resolution. Some calls to the administration to really make a priority to review the folks on the front line, the folks really making the effort towards changing this culture, and make sure that they have the resources they need, they have the people that they need. So it's not a call to do anything specific other than reach out to these folks really on the front lines making the impact and make sure that they have everything they need. Seek staff input and involvement in these activities going forward in a meaningful way. because we need to be a part of this. We are a part of this community, and we are both impacted and directly involved. So consider the creation of a central office focused on institutional equality. The idea here, and I don't know whether it's a viable option or not, that's why I'm including the word consider, but it seems like having a specific point person, point of contact line item is making this a priority. And finally, defining the roles of the university diversity officers. And some of this language, Ulysses would be far better at explaining what it means, because this is what he does for a living. And I have reached out to him in that capacity to help inform these steps. One thing. And the finally resolved is that the university and administration and the university as assembly, particularly the codes and judicial committee, consider some revisions to their code of conduct and policy 6.4. I'm on the codes and judicial committee. Some of that's already actually happening. So there's already been some communication. There's some debate yet over the specific language in that statement, and that may be subject to change, but that's a discussion that we should open up and have.
Great. Thank you. So before we leave, because I just want to underscore what Jeremy said, is that this is not being brought to you today, but it is important. And I really do implore you all to take this back to your constituent groups, read it with them, read it in your downtime to think through and get some feedback, not just on what's already in the resolution, but on some other things that you all think we could be doing, or staff could be involved, particularly university could be doing in terms of helping advance this. Just even in hearing the performance management, I swear every time we get together, you all tell me some horror story about something that's going on in your area, some horrible practice, and we just don't know these. So yeah, my view is very central. Jeremy's view, Jeremy has a view from, you know, what he knows on the UA and the CJC and from where he sits, but all of us bring in these perspectives. So it's important that, you know, there are things that need to be taken out of the resolution, things that need to be added. We want to hear that perspective. So we're a bit over time, so I'm going to have to adjourn the meeting, but I am going to ask you all for our next meeting to come prepared, really, to really have kind of an open discussion about these things. And feel free to reach out to Jeremy. He's the sponsor with some questions or additional thoughts in the interim. So don't wait until the last minute to talk. So with that, is there a motion to adjourn? We're over time.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
No dissent. I'll see you all later. Take care. Thanks for bearing
with
the difficulties.
Yeah,
I tried to talk as fast as I could.
Yeah, we really felt like the statement needed to get out right away, and we didn't want to rush the resolution. That's why there's there, so we have time to do due diligence on the resolution.
You want us to explore the idea of adding additional things, not just the things under the campus code, kind of appearance, clothing, manner of dress, age.
There really wasn't time to suggest one. I didn't want to suggest it after Charlie.
When the employee survey went out, it only talked about that entire.
But as someone who
has. But there's so many other ways
people could have.
They take at least one semester of management class,
so that they understand.
Yeah.
Sometimes they just really don't have any concept.
Yep.
Some are good,
or somebody who's
some are
trans,
not very good at all.
Right.
They're focused on their own stuff. Yeah.
The
employees.
That's
how I got.
The whole same thing.
Oh, that's good.
Back to regulations.
That's great if it's
your
own.
This is your salary.
I
worked for 26 years at UMass. I told him he should have had a manager.
Yeah, and sometimes Lard, you want to go? I got to hand over to Nye, so
yeah,
one person, you know,
so
wants
I
to
think
develop,
there should
and
be some
then
kind of training
I'm going to,
actually,
my son's going to pick me up. So,
so no, thank you.
We did have a new supervisor development program that most of our staff go through.
Right, but it might be interesting to add just to have a, you know,
right,
a faculty.
Yeah.
Maybe we just have faculties that know it too.
So it would just be four faculty members, right?
I would be, even if I put some of those thoughts on.
Yeah.
I would really like to, personally, my brain is not quite so much.
And, you know, for anybody.
Sensibility of order, you know.
Oh, we've got, you know.
The EA getting rid of.
I am.
Kind of alleviate that, you know, complaint.
Can't do that, sorry.
But I
wanted to let you know too, I'll send an email to you and Peggy. About the staff recognition and awards committee that yesterday.
Yeah, I'm sorry we couldn't be.
But we got to have, it's like, well, you look like that would be an art that has to be sunshine.
Yeah.
You know, that is not.
Yeah.
Well, he's gonna, I'm going to the George Peter.
Yes.
And then potentially.
Yeah.
You're gonna.
Yeah, it's not sort of like that mix up.